Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works, who discusses Trump's popularity despite his increasingly fascist rhetoric and the violence he incites among supporters. Dr. Sandra Steingraber, co-founder of Concerned Health Professionals of New York, who talks about the new edition of Compendium on Fracking that finds serious health hazards linked to home use of natural gas. And Christopher Pearson of the group National Popular Vote, who discusses the campaign to bypass the Electoral College system to elect U.S. presidents in favor of determining the winner based on who receives the most votes in all 50 states. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Leaders of the African nation of Namibia are calling for direct talks with Germany over reparations and the return of ancestral lands seized by white settlers after the genocide committed against the Herero and Nama tribes in the early 1900s. During that time, German settlers pushed indigenous tribes off their land, which became German-dominated Southwest Africa. Today, the nation is called Namibia. The Herero and Nama people who resisted the settlers were starved to death, forced into concentration camps, and deported to British colonial territories in Botswana and South Africa. According to Foreign Policy magazine, an estimated 80% of the Herero and 50% of the Nama population were killed between 1904 and 1908, with a total number estimated at as many as 100,000 people. Historians have described this slaughter as the first genocide of the 20th century, overshadowed by the later Nazi Holocaust, which killed 6 million European Jews. Some Namibians have pointed to a double standard in the reaction to these two genocides. Germany has paid about 82 billion euros in reparations to Israel, including direct payment to victims, but has refused to directly compensate the Herero and Nama people. 20 years ago, the pesticide acephate was banned in the European Union. The bug killer used on celery, tomatoes, cranberries, and other fruits and vegetables has been linked to neurodevelopmental disorders such as autism, hyperactivity, and lower scores on intelligence tests in children. ProPublica reports that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is relying on industry-backed testing to ease regulation of the insecticide despite scientific advisory panels' warnings. The EPA's proposal, in consultation with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, was based on new test results designed to measure the impact of chemicals on the developing brain. The studies involved disembodied cells rather than whole lab animals and found little to no evidence that a chemical created by acephate, when it breaks down in the body, harms growing brain tissue. Several scientific groups said the test had major limitations and warned against using the results of non-animal testing to dismiss concerns. The Economist magazine reports from 2010 to 2020, a quarter of all U.S. counties lost population, a trend expected to increase as overall U.S. population growth slows. During the COVID pandemic, many rural communities and states shrank. Over 500,000 more people died in 2020 than in 2019, and the birth rate fell. In 2021, 17 of 50 states lost population despite growth in some states like Texas. Cairo in southern Illinois is an example of this population freefall. High hopes of prosperity have been dashed for decades. Main Street buildings and historic Victorian houses have been abandoned and left to rot. Today, the town doesn't have any gas stations, pharmacies, or a hospital. Its population fell to 1,700 in 2020 from a peak of 15,000 a century ago. Once communities start shrinking, business losses and property abandonment become a vicious cycle, where residents choose to move to lower-cost states. Such downturns also fuel America's growing political divide between red and blue states. Of the counties that have lost population since 2020, 90% voted for Donald Trump. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After Donald Trump clinched the Republican Party presidential nomination, the former president has spent most of his time in a New York City courtroom in the hush money trial involving payments made to an adult film actress before the 2016 election. While corporate media reports on the campaign between Trump and President Biden narrowly focused on the horse race, little attention is being paid to the former president's many lies about the 2020 election or his quotes from Adolf Hitler, as he attacks leftists, Marxists, and immigrants as vermin, poisoning the blood of the country. At his campaign rallies, Trump talks openly about establishing a dictatorship on day one of his administration, should he win the 2024 election, and his intention to fire tens of thousands of government civil servants who refuse to pledge their loyalty to him. Trump is the first former president and presidential candidate to be charged with felonies, and now faces 88 counts in 4 federal and state criminal cases. Your reporter spoke with Jason Stanley, Jacob Rawoski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University, and author of the book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Here he discusses Trump's continued popularity, despite his increasingly fascist rhetoric, the violence he incites as he issues threats targeting his perceived enemies, and corporate media coverage of the threat Trump poses to democracy.
Trump has created a sort of showman narrative straight out of early to mid 20th century European fascism, Mussolini and Hitler. Like, he is the aggrieved one, and it's this narrative of reclaiming the nation, and they're trying to get him, and it grips people. It's like a show. The Frankfurt School, who discussed European fascism, Nazism particularly, talked about the leader transforming politics into spectacle. And we're seeing almost a textbook case of that in the case of Donald Trump.
As you've talked about in recent years, U.S. corporate media has long resisted calling out Trump for his authoritarian and fascistic rhetoric, as well as his actions in office. In recent months, some of the major newspapers, and I would cite the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic magazine, among them, have raised the alarm in some, you know, headlines. And they've talked about the threat that Trump poses more so than they have in recent years. Why are they so late in identifying Trump as a threat to democracy? And what does our media need to do now, in your view, in advance of the November election, to further warn the American people about the Trump Republican threat to U.S. democracy?
The media has spent so many years saying this isn't the case, that there's some other explanation, that it's not just what it obviously is, that they're a bit embarrassed about walking back their absurdity over the past 5 or 6 years or whatever, when all of this fascism talk and autocrat talk and authoritarianism talk was relegated to neither the left-wing press or the centrist press. But the New York Times is very reluctant to go that way until recently. So now what do you do? You have a media environment in which Trump is very cleverly, not at all like a charlatan, behaving exactly like any fascist would, claiming the other side is the Democratic threat. And being extremely open about his intentions. He's going to replace everyone in the government by loyalists. He's going to target the universities, the schools. This process is called Gleichschaltung in the literature on Nazi Germany, where every organization, every government institution turns loyalist like is transformed. Their employees are replaced by people loyal to the leader and loyal to the party. And Trump has already announced he's going to do this. So he's already announced a full fascist plan. He hasn't announced a genocide of a particular group other than immigrants and LGBT, traditional targets of fascists. In any other conceivable sense, what we have is a fascist social and political movement with a fascist leader. And so the media, you know, what is the media? Do I have a recipe for the media? Well, they can't both side or anymore. You know, they can't treat this as a horse race. Well, it's a horse race between autocracy and democracy. And there's no reason to think democracy will be more popular. It often isn't.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to just ask you this last question, Professor Stanley. On the topic of violence, Trump regularly issues threats to his perceived enemies, judges, prosecutors, election officials. This has resulted in armed attacks, bomb threats, swatting attacks more recently, and mass murder in the case of white supremacists and anti-Semites whose attacks in Buffalo, Pittsburgh, and El Paso, incited by Trump's language and other Republicans and right-wing media commentators spewing racism and hate. I mean, people are dying around this country because of this incitement. What is your concern about this election season we're in and the prospect of more violence than we've even seen in the last couple of years?
Well, I don't know if concern is the word I'd use, because I expect there to be a lot more violence. I mean, look at what happened to Paul Pelosi. Somebody, you know, hopped up on conspiracy theories, hit him with a hammer. The rhetoric that we're hearing completely justifies political violence. The supporters who are listening to this rhetoric have a lot of guns. I don't understand why people are surprised when the sun rises, you know. The sun is going to rise, or the sun is going to set on American democracy, and that process will be very violent.
That was Jason Stanley, Jacob Rawoski, professor of philosophy at Yale University, and author of How Fascism Works. His newest book is titled Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. This interview was previously broadcast on January 17th this year. Find more analysis and commentary on the threat Donald Trump poses to democracy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When New York State was considering whether or not to permit the fossil fuel extraction method known as fracking in the middle of the 2010s, a group of scientists and health professionals researched all the peer-reviewed studies they could find on the topic. They collected about 400 papers, assembling them together into easy-to-understand language, with findings that there are both negative health and climate impacts from natural gas fracking, which is still widely used in neighboring Pennsylvania. Dr. Sandra Steingraber is a biologist, and one of the scientists who worked on the project called the Compendium on Fracking. Their research helped convince then-Governor Andrew Cuomo to ban fracking in New York. Steingraber's group, called Concerned Health Professionals of New York, has released a compendium every year since 2014. The ninth edition, published in collaboration with Physicians for Social Responsibility, was just released in October. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dr. Steingraber about the 2,500 peer-reviewed studies now included in a fully searchable public document, with an emphasis on the hazards of gas stoves and liquefied natural gas, or LNG.
We've just released the ninth edition. There are now more than 2,500 studies in the peer-reviewed literature, so essentially six times as much evidence as there was in 2014 when New York State took the decision to ban fracking. And all of those studies pretty much corroborate, showing us that fracking is even worse for health and the environment than we thought, and in ways that are even more intractable and unfixable than we realized. So public health data tends to be very, what we call, noisy. But in this case with fracking, it's very consistent. 90% of the studies that have gone out to look to see if there are risks and harms of fracking have found them. And so as we continued to release these updated studies, we also began to expand our focus because people were asking us questions about, well, what about pipelines and compressor stations and fracked gas power plants? What about gas storage facilities and the sand mining that accompanies frack mining? And what about gas stoves inside our home, which represent the terminus of the fracking pipeline? So as with each edition that we've released over the years, we have added new chapters and new subject matters to it. And so this year, we took a really close look at gas stoves and gas appliances. And from our perspective as public health scientists, we see the combustion of fracked gas inside of our homes as the terminus of the fracking pipeline. Literally, the pipeline begins where the fracked gas comes out of the ground and the shale bedrock is shattered, and it ends inside of our own kitchens with the combustion of that fracked gas, which leads to indoor air pollutants that it's very clear that they create risks for health, namely asthma in children, but also heart attack and stroke risk in adults. And so this edition is getting a lot of attention, I think, because people have deep emotional feelings and, deep familiarity with their kitchen stoves in ways that compressor stations and flare stacks and other parts of the fracking infrastructure project, we don't have this sort of domestic intimate relationship with. I'm a single mom myself. I would make dinner on my stove while overseeing homework at the kitchen counters.
Like, people have been cooking with gas stoves in their homes for decades, and you know, nobody knew that it was a problem. So how are they showing health impacts?
Well, we were surprised to find that gas stoves have been studied thoroughly to look at their impact on respiratory health with data going back to the 70s. So there are dozens of studies. They're all very consistent and they're all very troubling. And so our job as scientists in the public interest was to really pull all of these studies together out of the sort of obscurity of the peer-reviewed medical literature, translate them into plain spoken English, and then present them to the public. And that is what we do in all the chapters of the compendiums, according to 16 topic areas. But we also then look at trends in the data across topic areas and summarize those. So you don't have to read, you know, all 2,500 footnotes to get a sense of what the trends look like. And so we do this for gas stoves, but we also do it for pipelines. We also do it for flare stacks and compressor stations. We look at risks for earthquakes. We look at risks for radiation exposure. We look at air pollution, water contamination, climate risks, health risks of all kinds, worker health and safety issues. So we have chapters on all of these things.
So one other thing I wanted to ask you about is that over the last several years, the U.S. has become the top exporter of liquefied natural gas, so-called, or LNG, which has such a huge carbon footprint and also huge implications for public health, especially in the Gulf Coast, where most of them are located. Does your new compendium look at the latest on that?
LNG is a big topic for our new compendium. It has its own chapter and is identified in the front matter as one of the big trends. Yes, liquefied natural gas is the form of fracked gas that we use when we want to sell gas to some place where pipelines don't reach, namely across oceans. And so liquefied natural gas is actually created not through pressure. You can't actually liquefy methane and turn it into a gas. You have to use cryogenics. And so it's super chill down to, you know, minus 400 degrees where it turns into a liquid and is more compact. The volume then shrinks remarkably. And so you can load it on ships and send those ships to some other nation state. So we are basically shattering the bedrock of our nation to extract this vapor, methane, carbon with four hydrogens around it, liquefy it, and send it all around the world. And there are risks and harms to the communities where the LNG terminals are located. It's a lot of air pollution because in order to purify the gas during the chilling process, there are a lot of impurities in the gas that would freeze, and you have to vent those out, and that includes benzene. So a lot of these dangerous other hydrocarbons that are mixed in with the gas are vented into the communities where LNG is created in order to super chill the gas and load it on the ships.
That was biologist Dr. Sandra Steingraber, co-founder of Concerned Health Professionals of New York. This interview was previously broadcast on November 8th last year. Find a link to the compendium on fracking and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the 2024 U.S. presidential election draws near, there's renewed attention on America's undemocratic electoral college system that elected both Donald Trump president in 2016 and George W. Bush in 2000, despite the fact that both these Republican Party candidates lost the national popular vote. A mid-November survey by the Stack Data Strategy polling firm added to concern on this issue when it found that if an election had been held in the fall of 2023, Trump would again win the Electoral College in the presidency, while President Joe Biden would win the national popular vote by 2 million ballots, repeating what happened in 2016 and 2000. A separate poll conducted by the Pew Research Center found 65% of U.S. adults say the way the president is elected should be changed so that the winner of the popular vote nationwide wins the presidency. Only a third favored keeping the current electoral college system. To that end, the group National Popular Vote has waged a campaign that calls for all of a state's electoral votes to be awarded to the presidential candidate who wins the most popular votes nationwide. The Interstate Compact, as it's called, will take effect once states with a collective total of 270 electoral votes join. To date, the compact has passed in 16 states and Washington, D.C., totaling 205 electoral votes, needing 65 more electoral votes to go into effect. Your reporter spoke with Christopher Pearson, board secretary with the group National Popular Vote, and a former longtime Vermont state legislator. Here he discusses the status of the campaign to ditch the electoral college system to elect U.S. presidents.
So we are unique in the advanced world for having an electoral college, for electing the second place candidate, which happened now twice in our lifetime, five times in the country's history. We've only had 46 presidents, so that's a pretty bad error rate, 5 out of 46. And to frankly have, in a Democratic election, to have a system that doesn't treat every vote equally, there really is something to the principle one person, one vote. But our effort, National Popular Vote, is once again asking states to use the Electoral College differently and just ratify the candidate that gets the most votes in the country. And we're well on the way to doing that. We need to pass this bill in a handful more states, and at which point we'll still have the Electoral College because states can't eliminate it, but it will just be a rubber stamp for whichever candidate gets the most votes in the country. And along the way, we make every vote equal, one person, one vote. And we make every voter matter in every state in every election. That's a big one. And finally, we just guarantee you get the most votes in the country, you go to the White House.
As I understand it, Chris, only 65 more electoral votes are needed to implement the national Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Is there any chance that's going to happen before the 2024 election?
Probably not. But we do think 2024 could be the last election where we do it under this current system. So we're aiming at 2028 being the first election where the president campaigns in all 50 states and talks to voters everywhere and is guaranteed to be the candidate that gets the most votes. So not quite in time for a year from now, but hopefully this is the last one that we're about to see. And, you know, a lot of people are motivated for different reasons to support National Popular Vote. But one of them is that we do seem to routinely be looking at the possibility of electing the second place candidate. There's a lot of polls coming out now telling us that Donald Trump could win re-election. In none of those polls does he get the most votes in the country. So, you know, for a lot of people, that's just not right. No matter what you think of Biden or Trump or any of them, you know, there is something strange about rewarding the second place candidate with the White House. And so it's a very relevant topic, but unfortunately we're not likely to get enough states on board in the next 6 months.
Right.
But we are working hard, and I think 2024 could be our last election under the system as we know it today.
Well, Chris, I did want to ask you generally about the erosion of democracy. With the loser of the presidential election losing the popular vote in both 2000 and 2016, it certainly brings home why the popular vote matters so much. I mean, We have presidents who've been elected through the Electoral College who nominate Supreme Court justices as...
That's right. A majority of them right now, 5 out of 9, came to be Supreme Court justices, I guess, the second-place president.
Nominated by presidents who weren't elected by the popular vote, right? And certainly countless federal policies impacting the economy, foreign policy, the environment, immigration, minimum wage, health care and education, all these things are impacted by the president, the one who sits in the Oval Office. If you have presidents in the Oval Office who weren't elected by a majority of the country, you have a system of minority rule, which is antithetical to democracy. So this really counts for a lot. And one question I know you deal with a lot at National Popular Vote is concern that when the requisite number of states pass the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, that this will be challenged before the U.S. Supreme Court. So my final question for you tonight is, what is your level of confidence that when the states required vote in the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, that it will be deemed by the Supreme Court as constitutional?
I'm fairly confident that they'll back us up because National Popular Vote relies on what the court previously has called the plenary power of the state legislatures. And the Constitution itself doesn't say a lot about how we elect the president, but it is very clear that it hands the whole operation to the states. Article 2, Section 1 says, each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. So it's kind of just in the hands of state legislatures, and there is no parameters on that. So there's nothing to say that the Vermont legislature, where I had the pleasure of serving, can't say our three electors will go to the candidate that gets the most votes in the country.
That was Christopher Pearson, board secretary with the group National Popular Vote, and a former longtime Vermont state legislator. This interview was previously broadcast on January 3rd this year. Learn more about National Popular Vote's campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, KSER in Everett, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.